There's one thing I can't stand, it's a smart aleck kid.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Thank you for joining me today, and I look forward to chatting with you today in the spaces where it's not me or my guest talking. My number, 1-800-227-5278. Of course, Stand to Reason means that we stand to reason for classical Christianity and classical Christian values, and if you'd like to call me and talk about that, that was the number, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code here in Southern California, 754-4150 is the local number. And I'm so glad you've joined me. I really do have a pleasure talking with you every Sunday about the things that matter. 3 to 5 is our time, although we have been talking about, maybe I shouldn't say this. Can I say this? Talking about adding another hour, maybe. We don't know if it's going to work out here at the station or whatever, but I've gotten my wife's permission, so maybe we'll start an hour early. But we'll see, because a lot of people have asked for some more time, and I'm already here, so I might as well just stay another hour or come an hour earlier or something. That's in the works. We'll see what eventuates with that. There's always so much to talk about and so many things I'd like to pass on to you. Some things are kind of, you know, enduring nature. They're around for a long time. Other things just pop up, and I feel like I want to say something about them, and then a week passes, and they're hardly timely anymore. So maybe a little more time in the air will help us with that. First of all, coming up hour number two, our dear friend Scott Klusendorf is going to be on board. He's late of Stand to Reason, our former Director of Bioethics, and now he's with LTI Life Training Institute, and we're going to be talking to him about the current state of affairs dealing with abortion and what this new administration offers in that regard in terms of challenge, which is great on this question. So that'll be coming up next hour. I also want to respond in a few moments to a question that was raised last week that I felt like I wasn't really able to respond well to, that out of Luke chapter 6. And there's a parallel passage in Matthew 5 about turning the other cheek and about giving your cloak and give to him who asks you and don't resist those who are evil, those kinds of things. I think I can make a little more sense of that now. Before I get to that, though, I saw last night the last half of a DVD of Charlotte's Web, and we thought it would be good for Annabeth. Eva doesn't care about those things. She doesn't make sense of it. But we were a little concerned about Annabeth because there was a spider in it, and this was a big spider, and it was a realistic spider, and we thought she'd get freaked out. And it turned out that she watched this whole thing at my brother's house last weekend, and it didn't bother her, so we decided to watch it as a family. What did bother her was not Charlotte's Web, but Shrek throwing a cat out a window in a preview to Charlotte's Web. And honest to goodness, last night she's in bed and she's crying. What was it? What are you frightened about? I'm afraid someone's going to throw me out the window. It's amazing what kids pick up on, isn't it? So we comforted her. Don't worry, that'll never happen. Daddy will protect you. Papa is here. Mommy won't let that happen. So that worked out. But two thoughts about this movie. This wonderful story written by E.B. White, and I'd be very interested to see how closely the movie matches the book itself, because I have a suspicion it has been brought up to date with political correctness. I'm not sure, because I probably read the story, you know, 40 years ago or something like that. I don't know. But I just was suspicious as I'm watching this movie. So I have two reflections, quick ones about it, and I have no objection to anybody renting this video. It's not even PG, it's G. It's easy. And it's cute. But there's something about it that bothered me and something I liked. Here's what I liked. The special effects are flawless. Unbelievable. You want to know what it looks like for a pig to talk? Or a duck? Or a horse? Or a cow? Or a rat? Watch this movie. I could not see any flaws. I'm looking at the rat. And the rat, what's his name? Can't remember it right now. But the rat, looks like a rat, except for he's talking. And his lips are moving just right, and his head is tilted just the way it ought to be, and he's turning and flipping and jumping and... Thank you, but I just lost my mic when you did that. Templeton, thank you. So, Templeton is doing all these things like a rat. Very amazing. And all the other characters, too. So I was so taken with this that, in a way, it was hard to ruin the movie for me, but there was something that really troubled me. Now, those of you who remember this movie, if you saw it, the little girl is Dakota Fanning, and played nicely by her. I mean, Fanning is quite flexible as an actress, I think, and I've always been impressed with her ability. How do kids act so well? How do little kids do so well? How do they memorize all those lines? I'm amazed at that. But they're very compelling. And she is, especially. This isn't a very challenging part that she has to play, but it's still, it's all right. So she does this deal. It's the character that troubles me. Because if you know how the story goes, apparently this pig, which is central to the whole movie, is going to be sacrificed because mama can't feed it, all right? There's no room in the inn. Let's just put it that way. There's more pigs than nipples. All right, so dad's going to take the pig and make baby bacon out of it. And Dakota Fanning sees this, and she objects. Oh, I understand how kid would, but her dad properly says, look, it's a pig. Can't survive like this. This is the way we do things here at the ranch. Pigs are, you know, expendable. Actually, they're here because they're expendable. We don't just raise them for fun. They're food. And she objects, you can't do that, it's not fair. Would you kill me if I was a runt? It's the question. He says, no, but you're not a pig. Good lesson. Then she says, well, I'd be just as dead, as if the fact that both will be deceased by being killed makes the actions morally equivalent. In fact, it's at this point that the protection of the life of this pig becomes an act of justice. So this is where it would have been right for dad to step in and say, honey, you are deeply confused. Let me instruct you. People are not animals. Animals are not persons. We treat them with the respect due them as creatures that God has made, but we do not treat them like human beings. This one's going. Learn a lesson. In fact, I think it was a few weeks ago when Annabeth was here, we had a conversation about cats on the way into the studio, and she mentioned one of our cats was in heaven. That was my opportunity to clarify that cats aren't people. Cats, when they die, they just disappear, essentially. They're gone, as far as I know. But heaven is a special place for special creatures, creatures who are like God in some way, and therefore we get to be with God forever. Now, that was an opportunity for teaching. You know, Annabeth didn't put up a big fuss. She didn't squeal and moan and cry and kick. She considered, and she was instructed, and she got it right. But in the movie, the Dakota Fanning character fussed and demanded and got her way. And she said, it's a matter of justice. That's not fair. This isn't just. And so she gets her way. Now, there's nothing wrong with letting a kid take care of a pig, all right? I think it's good for kids to have animals they have to take care of. It's the pretense under which this pig was saved. It's an act of justice because we wouldn't do this to children. By the way, she didn't fight for the other pigs that were happily nursing on mom, which were all destined for the smokehouse 6 or 8 months further down. In any event, throughout the movie, every time that Dakota Fanning character wanted something, she stomped her foot, essentially, demanded it, and walked off and got her way. And this is troublesome to me because this is a G movie, right? This is a movie for kids. It's for everyone. It's safe. And what the G's and PG's and R's and X's don't do is actually filter out the values messages that can be sometimes much more damaging in the long run than the sex and violence, the naughty words or whatever. And here is a value. Here is a characterization of a dad who is trying to be dad, but he was controlled by his child. And he was, and even the reasons that she asserted herself were bad reasons. Even if an adult were to do that, a peer to dad, the reasons would have been faulty. There's a misinformation or profound misunderstanding about the nature of reality and life going on there. But worse when it happens with a child, and then the child gets her way by force of character. And she did every single step of the way. And of course, the movie, the way the movie develops, she is applauded. And indeed, as again, I don't know if this is in the original, but the whole community is changed by this act of justice by the daughter. It's transformed. They look at each other in a different way. They love each other a little bit more. They're kinder to each other. Even Templeton the rat gets changed at the end. And of course, Charlotte the spider has a lot to do with this, but I'm mostly concerned, and I don't have any objection to her whole input. That's kind of nice. But it was the way this gal is carrying on. And at one point, the father, as he loses once again in a showdown with his, 11-year-old daughter, says, gee, she's only like 11. In three more years, I'll never be able to win an argument with her. So what's the lesson there that is being communicated? Well, first of all, he never did win an argument with her anyway in the movie. She won every single time. Secondly, parents are not supposed to win over children because they persuade them of the wisdom of their thinking. Parents aren't supposed to win arguments. Parents are the ones that God has put in a position of authority over the children, and in virtue of the authority, the children are supposed to learn to obey, because there will never be a time in the child's life when she or he will not be under authority that before God they are obliged to obey. And so it's good for them to learn young. And that isn't happening there. And what troubles me, oh, this is just a movie. It's a movie that communicates something powerfully and visually through the medium of film. It's intended to do that. That's why people make movies, or at least it's part of the reason, to make statements in this subtle but powerful way. And that troubled me about the movie, especially since I'm tuned into these things, since I have children of my own, 4 and 1. Children that we want to respond to us first, at least early on, because God has placed mom and dad in a position of authority over them. And that's what really matters in this debate. What mom and dad say, because God has given them the authority. Now, we are restricted by the authority that we are under, and that is God himself. So we're not, you know, free agents here. We're not autonomous beings. We don't get to tell the kids anything we want. They got to obey just because we said. Well, they do need to obey just because we said, but we don't have the freedom to say anything we want because we are also under authority. Anyway, so that's my concern with Charlotte's Web. You'll not only see it there, but I promise you, no matter what you watch, certainly network TV, you're going to see it there as well. Quickly to the passages, make that Luke 6:27 through 36, and the Matthew passage also in Matthew 6. 38 and following. These are parallel passages, but you recall these passages where Jesus is talking about, you know, turning the other cheek and giving to everyone who asks you. And if they resist you, don't withhold from them. If they want to take your shirt or your coat, give them your shirt. If they want to take your shirt, give them your coat. You know, don't ask for anything to be returned. Turn the other cheek and this kind of thing. So I talked a little bit about the turn the other cheek issue last week. By the way, I think that these are deeply misunderstood passages, but I understand why they're not easy. And there's been some wrong understandings about how we take these, and so people just bought these kinds of ideas. With regard to turning the other cheek, Jesus is saying, rather than an eye for an eye and a tooth for the tooth, turn the other cheek. By the way, eye for an eye and a tooth for the tooth, it's called the lex talionis in law. It's called the law of the talon, was a principle that God himself gave in the Old Testament. It is a principle of justice. Basically, you should give a punishment that is proportionate with the crime. So an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You don't cut somebody's hand off because they stole a loaf of bread. So it is a principle of justice. Jesus is not denying the principle of justice. If he were, he would be denying his own revelation on a high Christology, because God himself gave that for governments to follow. What he is saying there is that rather than you, when you suffer injury, particularly take an offense, notice the Matthew passage says, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek. How do you strike somebody on the right cheek if you're right-handed? You are right-handed, you are facing someone, you are going to strike them. How do you strike them on the right cheek? Most people are right-handed, by the way. The only way you can strike them on the right cheek is by reaching across your body and slapping them with the back of your hand. Now, what is it when somebody slaps you at the back of the hand? That's an insult. That isn't a blow to damage, although it does sting and could hurt. The point Jesus is making is, when you have someone who's given you a personal insult, you cannot take the principle of justice that God ordained for governments and employ it yourself. If someone injures you or insults you, you don't return in kind. Vengeance is mine, said the Lord. So instead, you leave room for the vengeance of God. You act in a way that's different from your natural impulse, and you suffer the indignity and don't strike back. I mentioned, by the way, when Jesus was struck on the cheek, he did not turn the other cheek. He didn't say, oh, you hit me here? Take a shot on this side. At his trial, when he was struck on the cheek, he said, if I have done anything wrong to essentially justify this blow, bear witness to the wrong, and if not, then why do you strike me? In other words, he asked for an accounting. So that's another indication that Jesus doesn't mean that we should just go out and stick our neck out and have other people pummel our face if they want to. That's not the point. These are all kind of figures of speech in which Jesus is using something like a hyperbole. Like, for example, when somebody wants to take your coat or your tunic. And this is a suit in law, basically. And you go to and you get sued. The Jewish law said you can't take the coat. You can take the tunic that's underneath it, but you can't take the coat. And Jesus is saying, look, if this is people want to sue you or go after you like this, if they want to treat you unkindly, basically, then, you know, go beyond what is required. Don't resist that. Now, again, this is hyperbolic. It's an exaggeration for the sake of effect. How do I know this? Because Jews wore three pieces of clothing, a coat, and underneath that, a tunic, and underneath that, BVDs. The loincloth. So if they're in a court of law and they're getting sued and they give up their coat and then they give away their tunic, guess what? They're sitting there in the court in their undies. And they aren't going to walk home in their undies. The point Jesus is making, he's using this illustration to say, look, let's not resist. Let's go along with, let's go the extra mile. And in fact, one of those illustrations, if anyone wants you to go 1 mile, go two. That's in the Matthew passage. Well, this is because sometimes people were pressed into service by the military to carry stuff for a mile, and they didn't like that. It was unjust. It made people furious. Jesus said, don't retaliate. Just do it. In fact, go an extra mile. He's communicating a certain attitude that you should have in these circumstances. He's not establishing a new set of laws for behavior. And the attitude is to not take offense, but rather to forgive, bless those who curse you. that kind of thing. With regards to the loaning, it says in the Matthew passage, give to him who asks you and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. In the Luke passage, it says lend. That's probably the Luke parallel construction is what Jesus has in mind here. If somebody wants to borrow from you because they have deep need is the point, don't try to make a buck off of them. Just lend. Don't expect anything in return. In other words, any interest for your money when you're helping somebody that maybe might steal from you because he's got deep personal need. Step out, give, and don't expect interest in return. By the way, I think the place where it says in Luke to lend makes it clear that the person expects the money back, though not with interest. If a person was not to expect the money back, then it wouldn't be a loan, it would be a gift, wouldn't it? And anyway, so I think those are some reflections that, based on my study, begin to make some more sense out of this passage. You understand it more in the context of the demands or the issues of the culture there, and also it becomes pretty apparent that Jesus is using hyperbole, exaggeration for the sake of effect, to communicate a very basic principle, the heart attitude, that there is a better righteousness, there is a going the extra mile, not taking offense, being willing to forgive. And of course, Jesus' point there is following in the next section that we should love our enemies and pray for those who despitefully use us and whatever. Hard words, yes. Even understood, I think, more accurately this way. Still pretty hard words, but counsel that is supposed to reflect more of the changed nature and changed attitude that we have now that we're followers of Christ. All right, time to go to the calls. First, a break, 1-800-227-5278. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians, and it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason, giving you something worth thinking about every weekend, and that would be classical Christianity. Which I think is worth thinking about. It's kind of a tagline here at STR, Stand to Reason. Let's go to the phones and go to Albany, Kentucky. And Brad, glad you called. You're number one on the list here today. Hi.
Well, hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yes, sir. My question deals with the nature of morality with Christianity and its consistency.
Uh-huh.
I know as we as Christians, we hold that objective morality is rooted in God's character and his nature.
Yes, uh-huh. That's the way I would characterize that, right. I believe morality is objective, and the best way to explain its objective nature is that it comes from God. Some people, you know, are ground it differently, but the objective quality of morality is something different than the way it is grounded or how where it comes from or what makes sense of it, okay? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good.
And of course, I was discussing this with a non-believer.
Okay.
He brought up the fact, he said, well, if you as a Christian believe this and you believe that the Old Testament is true, just like the New Testament, then why would God advocate certain things, such as stoning homosexuals or idolaters or adulterers, and saw that was good to do so? But in the New Testament, it seems like it shies away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it points out like there's inconsistency there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know how to respond.
All right. So they're dealing with a very specific example here, and the homosexuality and the stoning of homosexuals, right?
Well, they just was pointing out he gave several examples, but he's just saying that, you know, in the New Testament, it doesn't seem like you advocate there's certain things you don't execute. You don't execute people
right
anymore for certain things where they did in the Old Testament.
Okay, a couple of thoughts here. It wouldn't be inconsistent with the idea that morality is objective to have, under one set of circumstances, something be punishable by death, and under another set of circumstances, that same thing not be punishable by death. I'm going to say more about this, but part of the objection is they used to stone homosexuals. Now you don't advocate stoning homosexuals. Therefore, what you thought was wrong before, you don't think is wrong now. Consequently, in the first case, that morality was not objective, because if it were, it would be exactly the same today.
Yes, sir, basically.
That's their line of argument. And this is a faulty way of reasoning. It might be that something is objectively wrong under one set of circumstances, and later on that set of circumstances changes and it's not objectively wrong anymore. Let's just say you have an objective responsibility to obey the government, all right? Well, then when the government says the speed limit's 55, are you obliged to obey the government when the speed limit is 55?
Right.
Sure. Well, does the government have the liberty then to change the speed limit to 65? Sure. But that doesn't mean that when it was 55, it wasn't an objective obligation to obey the government. It's right to obey the government in both cases, all right? But government has the liberty to change some of the details of the law that is being violated or that is in question, okay? And I'm not saying this is true with every one of God's commands, but in virtue of the fact that God is the sovereign, whatever he commands, we are obliged to do. So he could command the Jews not to eat shellfish, and then later on he could say it's okay to eat shellfish. Not because there's anything wrong with eating shellfish itself, like it's a deep immorality, that the whole, you know, it's a universal absolute, but that for particular reasons he had at the time, he didn't want them to, and they were still obliged to obey that because he was God telling them what to do. So just a point here, some of the commands of God are objectively obligatory in virtue of the fact that it is God that is commanding it, and God himself might change the thing later because the thing in itself isn't wrong, it's just that God says no at that time. Okay?
All right.
All right, let me give you another illustration, because I don't want this to be missed. My 14-month-old child cannot handle knives. So when she reaches for a knife, she knows it's a no-no. Okay? When she tries to grab a knife, she's disobeying. She's doing something wrong. When my 4-year-old goes to take a knife, she's not doing anything wrong, because we have not prohibited some knives from her. So is the using of knives an absolute immorality, and now it's just relative because one does it and the other doesn't? No. The use of knives is not relevant here. It is rather the command that parents give, that is, it is always right to obey parents no matter what they tell you to do, basically. So in one case, we can disallow it from one child, and we can allow it for the other. Some moral rules are like that. We obey them because God says so under one set of circumstances, but the circumstances might change, and then therefore God might say, okay, well, this doesn't apply anymore. That's not true with all moral rules. There are some moral rules that are some things that are wrong in themselves. And unjustified taking of human lives. Thou shalt not murder is one. Honor thy father and thy mother. You know, and these are stealing and lying and coveting. These are seem to be more durable kinds of things, and they are anchored in the character of God, and therefore they don't change in themselves over time. It's never right to have a lustful hunger for that which isn't yours. And so God prohibits that. Okay. Now let's with that foundation in mind. You with me so far? Is that right,
yes,
Brad?
Sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. So let's just go to the homosexuality issue. Turns out that homosexuality is condemned in the Old Testament, and it's condemned in the New Testament. So God's condemnation of homosexuality hasn't changed at all. In both the Old and the New Testament, we have a kind of an understanding of what is wrong with homosexuality. In the Old Testament, it says, if a man lies with a man the way he lies with a woman, okay, you can fill in the blanks there, that's an abomination. So man in that situation is involved in a kind of activity that God created women for men for, not other men. So they are violating God's system, in a sense, or his design for sex. That's called an abomination in the Old Testament. What do we find in the New Testament? Romans 1. When men burn in their desire towards one another and abandon the function of the woman, that's a grave sin. So once again, homosexuality is condemned for the same reason. God designed men and women to function together sexually, and when they function with each other sexually, that is a violation that is deep and profound and an offense to God. Okay, now how do you deal with the so you can see that objective issue hasn't changed. You with me?
Yes, sir.
All right. How do you deal with homosexuality? Well, it kind of depends. God set up a theocracy in which he ruled according to a strict law. And there were many offenses in the theocracy that were capital offenses. There were actually 21 of them. That is, if you committed this crime, you got killed. One of them was homosexuality. Another was breaking the Sabbath. Another was children disobeying parents. Now, by the way, is it still wrong nowadays for children to disobey parents?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. But that has to do with the authority order that God has established. I was talking about it earlier. And it's still wrong, according to the New Testament, for homosexuality. There is some debate about the Sabbath, and so we'll just set that aside for the moment. But even though we both agree that it's wrong to disobey parents, do you think God intends for us to kill our children when they disobey us? Now?
Oh, no.
No. So what you have under the Mosaic Law, and this is something you cannot forget whenever you're talking about the whole of the Mosaic Law, is the Mosaic Law was a law given through Moses for Jews. Period. It is a Jewish covenant. It defines the way God was working with the Jews under the theocracy. I'm not saying there might be some things we might draw from counsel or instruction or whatever from the law, we can, but it was principally for the Jews. And so execution for those odd offenses, odd to us now, only applied under the theocracy for the Jews. There is no hint that outside of the Jewish nation under a theocracy that the same penalties must apply for all of those crimes with Gentiles. So this is not an example of relativistic morality. It is not an example of inconsistency. Just like it's not an example of inconsistency when I don't allow my one-year-old to handle knives, but I might allow my four-year-old to handle knives. It is a different situation.
Okay.
And therefore, the rules are going to be different. And by the same token, Under the theocracy, there were certain things that God obliged, that the people were obliged to do and be before God, that those who are not under a theocracy, which is all Gentiles, are not under that theocracy, for example. And I don't think Jews are under that theocracy even now. But no one that is not under the theocracy is under the obligations of the theocracy. The only time when the rules in the Mosaic covenant apply to people who are not under the Mosaic covenant is when those reviews reflect transcendent morality. And most of the Ten Commandments are like that, and certainly it seems the commandments regarding homosexuality are like that, because the same prohibition and condemnation is repeated in the New Testament under Gentile conditions. So it becomes clear that it is not just a narrow provision of the Mosaic Covenant, but it is in the Mosaic Covenant because it is a broader issue of morality for all people. Now, I realize that may seem a little complicated the way I put it all together, but you can get the podcast in Kentucky, You Must, and listen to it again to get those details down. Okay, Brad?
Yes, sir.
Maybe just for summary's sake, sometimes a thing is wrong simply because God tells us to do it and we didn't do it. And that's the kind of thing that God can change from time to time because circumstances change. This is true of our children. Even though we're obliged to obey the parents' rules may change from time to time. Other time, there are things that are wrong in themselves, and those don't change from time to time. And we find the same prohibitions in the Old Testament and the New Testament regarding those things. It appears that homosexuality is an example of the second, not the first. However, punishment for homosexuality is different under the theocracy than it is in Gentile governments nowadays. And there was a reason for that, by the way. God was, and I'll tell you what I think the reason is, God was trying to raise up a people who would be his beacon of light to the world to fulfill a kind of great commission that rested on the shoulders of the Jews. And if the Jews were thick with sin and corruption, they would be no better than the people they were trying to reach. And so God, he enclosed them with a wall culturally, and that wall was called the law. Now that wall has been broken down in the New Testament time, but then it was there to keep the Jews from being like the rest of the people around them, both culturally and morally. So there are very, very severe punishments for those that breached the wall. And God did that for the protection of the nation of Israel, which he intended to be the source of salvation for the world. So a lot more was at stake under those circumstances, and I think that explains some of the prohibitions. All right, Brad?
Yes, sir. I appreciate it.
Any follow-ups on that, or is that pretty clear?
That made sense to me.
Okay. All the best then, Brad. Thanks for the call from Kentucky. Got to run to a break right now, and then we'll get to Saske and Adam on their questions. Greg Kokel, Stand to Meet, to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. and these three self-directed studies will cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel here, giving you something we're thinking about every Sunday, 3 to 5 here at Stand to Reason. That would be 3 to 5 Los Angeles time. Many of you are listening, of course, on the all over the country on different stations, so you'd have to just do the math wherever you're at. I say that live time for those who are, at least for when I'm live here on the West Coast, for those who are listening through podcast, and you are Legion, which is wonderful as far as I'm concerned, that if you want to call in during the live show, that's when to call in, 3 to 5 Los Angeles time. Let's quickly go back to the phones, and this would be Sasuke. Welcome to the show, Sasuke, in Seattle.
Hello, Greg.
How are you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Very good. Before I ask my question, I would just like to tell you, Greg, you're very wise beyond your years, and I'm convinced your mind must be composed of forgotten metals because you're extremely intelligent.
Well, thank you. I'll tell my family members that you said that. They're not quite convinced of the wisdom beyond my years, but I appreciate your vote on that one. What's on your mind today, Sasuke?
So my question, I guess, is if a Christian wants to get into some, like, I guess, Chinese martial arts, some of, like, the, I know a lot of the deeper martial arts space, they kind of tap into, like, Eastern religion and Eastern philosophy and stuff like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
How would you approach that as a Christian without, like, getting into a weird situation, I guess, when it gets kind of really, like, Taoist or, those sort of religions that integrate
right.
with those kind of martial arts. Do you
right.
kind of understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand the question entirely. One of my old broadcasting buddies, who's a superb apologist himself and still broadcasting now on another station, kind of part-time, Craig Hawkins, used to sit at this same mic 5 days a week. Craig was actually, I think, a black belt in some kind of martial arts, and his opinion was that you could practice martial arts and learn the mechanisms, as it were, of them without participating in the spiritual enterprise the underlying, in many cases, underlie these practices. But he was always a little careful to say that it's possible, but it doesn't always mean that it's a good idea. He was well-trained. He was well-trained theologically, so he could eat the meat and throw away the bones. But my understanding is that, for the most part, a lot of these practices are not simply just how to defend yourself. I mean, if you want to learn how to self-defense, you learn, you know, Brazilian wrestling or Mav Gravda or something like that, to take them down and tear their eyeballs out kind of thing. but the martial arts are really a spiritual discipline. And this is why they have the katas. You're moving very slowly through these motions, not so you learn how to wang, 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 whop the guy, but you're doing something inside. You're forming your spirit. And so I would be very reluctant to want to send somebody into kind of a long-term learn, get your sensei and learn the spiritual, the discipline of martial arts, because martial arts is a spiritual enterprise, not just a physical kind of thing, not just a, you know, self-defense kind of thing. And that's the, you know, you got your key force, whatever, and your
like chi and all that, right. Like a lot of, some styles of Tai Chi, they really get into, like, Taoism and chi and karma and all that weird stuff.
Yeah. So I would, you know, what I would favor is, if you want to get a physical discipline for your body, take up ballet. Or go to the gym.
You're right.
Or go to the gym, you know. If you want to learn to defend yourself, take a tip from the Israelis and do a Mav Gravda or something like that, or maybe the Brazilian wrestling stuff, because that stuff is really good if you want to protect yourself. And if you want a deep, profound spiritual discipline, become a follower of Jesus Christ.
Right. And so in saying that, could you subsidize, like, some of the meditative aspects with maybe meditating on God?
Well, yeah. If you're involved in a discipline that involves martial arts that entails meditation, you're already over the top a little bit with that group. You're in the wrong group. And saying, well, I'm just going to meditate on God's word instead of doing the I Ching, or whatever that is, and, you know, your mantra deal, or, focusing on the Kundalini spirit at the bottom of your spine or something, that's already over the top. That is not a group that you want to be involved in. If your group is meditating in that way, then that's clearly a group that is deeply committed to the spiritual enterprise, and I think you should be out.
Okay. So then, I'm not trying to, like, sidestep what you said, I understand, but, like, on your own, I guess, if you were just studying by yourself and you just, I guess, took out all the physical aspects of it and just skipped all the spiritual, I mean, would that be...
Yeah, I guess I could do that. I could learn how to throw somebody, like a judo throw. I could learn how to somebody karate chop their neck or give them a punch to the solar plexus or kick their teeth out, you know. There's nothing spiritual out that's going to harm me in itself, but that's where I'd want to be really, really careful, you know, and I'm following it just to kind of defend myself. But anyway, got to move.
I guess.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I keep getting cut off. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, because even some of the stuff that has the spiritual aspect to it, there's still actual physical or self-defense aspects to it where you could just cut out the philosophical aspect.
Yeah, well, like I said, you got to eat the meat and throw away the bones, but it'd be a lot better if there weren't any bones in there at all, and that's what you should shoot for. Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go to Santa Clara, California, and Adam, welcome to Stand to Reason, Adam.
Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Hi. My wife and I recently relocated up to the Bay Area from L.A., and we've been going to a new church for a few months, and there's things we like about it, but a couple weeks ago, the pastor did a sermon on, well, more of an explanation on the church's view of women in ministry.
Right.
And
controversial issue.
Yes, and it's something I've never really had a position on, but most of the churches I've gone to have been more on the conservative end on that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But this church basically holds the view that women can do anything except be elders.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that mainly from 1 Timothy 2. And so they allow their women to be pastors. They give the title of pastor, but it's more of a high degree of responsibility.
Right, right.
Rather than like the senior pastor or the teaching pastor.
Yeah, well, I actually have the same view, if I understand what you said correctly. I don't get that from chapter 2, because chapter 2 in 1 Timothy is the one that seems, by some people, to restrict the teaching of women in the church. I actually get my view from chapter 3.
Yeah.
So I don't believe chapter 2 restricts women from teaching in the church, and I'll give you my reasons in a moment, but I do believe chapter 3 restricts women from being in the ultimate leadership of a church. So if a woman is a pastor under a male's leadership, I don't have any problem with that. If the woman is the head pastor and she is the chief leader in the church, then I do have a problem with that. It seems to me very clear in chapter 3, 1 Timothy chapter 3, that the elders, that is the ultimate leadership of the church, is to be male. It's a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. And then an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectful, on and on. And he must be one who manages his own household well, the man, keeping his children under control, the man. But and by the way, notice how if he is going to be manage the church, he's got to be able to manage his home, and the man is the head over the household. So he is. It is a male that is the head over both, and if one wants to be the head of the bigger thing, the church, he ought to be good at being the head over the smaller thing, his family. In right. fact, this is what Paul says in chapter 3, verse 5. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? And not a new convert, a good reputation, above reproach, etc. Now, it's interesting, when deacons are mentioned, women are mentioned in the context of deacons. So it appears that women can be deacons, but no women are mentioned in the context of being an elder, the high leadership of the church. So I take this to mean then, when he said man in the first half of chapter 3, he means that. All right. So that's why I believe that men should be the leaders of the church, but those who are under the leadership of men can be women functioning in all kinds of different ways, including teaching. Now, some will say, oh, no, they can't teach because chapter 2. So let me just read the passage that is in question, and I want to ask some questions about it of you, okay?
Okay, and I should say, but I've read your piece on this on your website, so I
okay.
kind of know where you're coming from, and I have a follow-up to that. But.
Okay, well, I'll make the quick point then for the sake of the other listeners.
Okay.
Verse 9, I want women to adorn themselves in proper clothing by means of good works, as befits a woman making claim to godliness. And here's operative verses, verse 11. I'm reading out the New American Standard here. Let a woman quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. But I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. All right? Now, those are the verses in question. If we read this to be simply women and men, we would have to conclude that every woman must receive instruction quietly with entire submissiveness from any other man in the church. That is, when it comes to this kind of authority, all men are above all women. And I don't think this is exact. What I think that sounds ridiculous. It's obviously wrong. When you look at the words that are translated woman and man, it is gune for woman and aner for man. And in fact, gune and aner can be translated husband and wife. And indeed, in almost every other case where they appear together and there seems to be a relationship between the gune and aner, it is almost always translated husband and wife, unless it's clear that the relationship in the context is not husband and wife. Then it's man and woman. There are two exceptions to this consistent translation of aner and gune as husband and wife, and one of them is right here. And the other one is in the Corinthians passage where it says man is the head of woman, and then God is the head of man, or however that goes. And I think in both cases it ought to have been consistently translated like other passages like it, where it says that husbands are head of wives. And therefore, this would read, and now tell me if this sounds natural in light of what you know about other passages that talk about husbands and wives. Therefore, verse 11, let a, that is an individual, not women, but a woman quietly receive, let a wife quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. I do not allow a wife to be the teacher or exercise or usurp, is the sense of it there, authority over her husband, but to remain quiet. Now, that is fully consistent with other passages that teach in the relationship of husband and wife, and it doesn't have these other problems. So this is why I favor the idea that women can be allowed to teach all kinds of ways in the church, but she is not to be allowed to be the head pastor or one of the elders over a church congregation. So you had a follow-up question about that, because you know this.
Well, really a couple. Actually, not that I wouldn't take your word for it, Craig, but I checked on the Greek, and it does appear that you're right, that it often is translated husband and wife. I found that most of the verses where it's translated husband and wife, those two Greek words,
yeah,
it's often like a possessive, so it's his wife or your wife,
uh-huh,
or ex's wife, So I'm not sure about verse 11, if that a wife is that standard, but I don't know Greek well enough.
Uh-huh. I think in all cases this is agune and also aner in this. I mean, I'm just going from my recollection when I did the lexical work myself.
Okay. But I agree that it seems to be more consistent with the remainder of Scripture, mm-hmm. the way you would translate it. My only concern is that no one does it. And not that that's a good reason to dismiss the point of view, but, you know, given the long history of Christianity, when something new comes up that I've never heard, I hear the music, but...
Yeah, and I'm sorry. What I'll just say briefly is it is not that no one does this. I think a lot of people do this, but there's a wide variety of applications of these passages. People are very consistent here. And consequently, I think it's common to misread given these kinds of translations, which would explain why people have practiced this in the past. But ultimately, it's the words itself and the Greek and the context and all that other stuff that makes the most sense. I think this demonstrates the impact of, cultural kind of biases here. Got to run. Thank you for the call. Coming up, Scott Klusendorf. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
Where's the beef?
All right, friends, Greg Kokel, hour number two. I'm fighting a losing battle here with my microphone. It's not one of these spring things, and it wants to straighten itself out and go to the ceiling. So we'll see if I can get this to work. Show a Stand to Reason. Good thing this isn't on video right now. I'm Greg Kokel, your chief stander. I need like a coat hanger or something to bend this into submission. All right, there we go. Got it. And I promised you a treat this hour. And whenever I want to kind of get a sense of the pulse beat of the pro-life movement, if I want to find out what's going on and what the issues are, of course I know the broader issues. And we have been training on those issues for 15 years, but there's always new things that pop up and new challenges and new things that are going on in the legal sphere, even though the big legal issue has to do with the courts. There's been a lot of progress that has been made over the years in smaller ways in state legislatures and the like that have made a difference in the number of abortions. There, people's minds have been changed in some degree about some of these issues. And so those are changes and shifts. And then when you get a whole new administration like we have now, that bodes all kinds of additional changes. And so to get a clear picture on those kinds of things, whenever I'm just in the dark a little bit or I'm a little fuzzy in my own thinking, I tap out my dear friend, Scott Klusendorf, who is the former director of bioethics at Stand to Reason, now the president of LTI Life Training Institute, the organization that he started when he left with our massive blessing to do this this new enterprise, now based in Atlanta, Georgia. Scotty boy, welcome to the show.
Greg, what a treat.
Well, I feel the same way, Scott. And it's just great to see you blossom and flower there where you've been planted in Atlanta. And I was just, you know, not to embarrass you, but I was just reflecting on this when I was driving out with Melinda to the studio. And I just think you are such a tremendous gift to the body of Christ. You are sharp. You're articulate. You are tactical and strategic, and you are a tremendous gift to the pro-life movement. And I'm glad you're on our side, Scott.
Well, thank you, Greg. That warms my heart to hear that. And if I may return the plug, I got to tell you, I've been through Tactics now twice.
The book. Okay.
And I'm just, and I've been through the DVD series as well, but they're both stellar. But the book most recently, and it's just tremendous. And I cannot wait to start carrying that in my own product line and getting it out to people. So nice job, and thank you for the kind words.
You're welcome, Scott. Thank you for that note, too. And actually, speaking of tactics, I saw a piece that you did a while ago that, and I want to talk about a little bit. I want to do two things here. I want to talk about this first piece where you have this conversation with a Roman Catholic nun of all people, and you employ the Columbo tactic in a very artful way, and you're dealing with a very specific kind of objection, which I'll introduce in a moment. And then when we cover that, I want to talk with you a little bit about the just what the future holds for the pro-life movement, and not just for the movement, but for I don't want to speak of the movement in the abstract so much, because it really amounts to individuals like you and I and a whole bunch of other people that are not, in a sense, in the business, but are that care about the justice, the social justice, when it comes to the life of the unborn, and what kind of obstacles all of us are going to be facing here, at least in the next 4 years. So, but this conversation you had with a Catholic nun, it was a stunner for me, Scott. Well, how did that start and begin to develop here?
I had spoken at her school outside of Orlando, Florida. She had about 500 students, high school students, and she came up to me afterward. And she was genuinely pleased at my presentation. Very nice woman, very gracious. And she said, you know, I loved your talk, and my only regret is that our students are not pro-life on all issues. She said, I'm consistently pro-life, and that's why I'm going to vote for Senator Obama. And, of course, my first reaction was, sister, help me out here, you know. She said, that's right, I'm going to vote for him because he's the real pro-life candidate. Mm. Most people focus too much on abortion, and I care about all life, and so does Obama.
And by the way, she's going beyond the kind of a fairly well-entrenched Roman Catholic view called the seamless garment argument, where you are pro-life with regards to the abortion question, but you're also against capital punishment.
Capital punishment, and you are for preserving the environment, and you want to see workers have good working conditions, and you want to see equitable wage distribution, that kind of thing.
So, and the war in Iraq kind of plays into that. But I just wanted to make the distinction that there is a fairly long-standing and, I think, noble position, though I don't agree with it, called the seamless garment argument, where the opposition to capital punishment is combined with the opposition to abortion.
That's right.
And in this case, it has been that notion has been, at least by this nun and many like her, expanded beyond recognition to include all of these other areas, almost to the point where these other areas, in her mind at least, seem to outweigh the abortion question itself, which is why she was in favor of Obama as a presidential candidate.
That's exactly right. In fact, when she said to me, most people focus too much on abortion, I threw out my first Columbo question. Mm-hmm. What do you mean people focus too much on abortion? Mm-hmm. And she had a quick answer. She said, look at what Bush has done with the war in Iraq. He has killed so many innocent people, and there's no way I could vote for someone like that. And John McCain would be just like him, and so I'm going to do the pro-life thing and vote for someone who's going to end that war. Mm. And, of course, I asked her, hey, are you saying then that the president unjustly killed these innocent people? And if so, how? And she really didn't have an answer there, but then here's what I think was the turning point in the conversation for me that really let me get a glimpse into where she was. I said to her, look, to be worse than abortion, how bad would an unjust war have to be? And her answer was this, Greg, abortion, war, poverty, they're all bad. Now what you're getting there is a kind of moral equivalence, and it's one of the big problems we have with some genuine pro-lifers who I believe their hearts are right, but they're just not morally tutored. Mm-hmm. They look at all these issues as being the same in terms of their moral weight. And Catholic Church teaching doesn't teach that. And so I asked her,
It doesn't teach that there's moral equivalence between.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Because the Church makes a distinction between absolute evils and those that are contingent, or, if you will, moral absolutes and prudential judgments. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to abortion, the Church teaching is clear. It's an intrinsic evil. It's absolutely wrong, absolutely evil. When it comes to war, the Catholic Church does not say it's absolutely and intrinsically evil. It says it might be contingently so.
Yeah, and for good reason, because wars lose innocent lives, but that's always going to be the case when you have a greater objective. And in fact, there's no way to wage a war, it seems to me, where innocent lives at least aren't lost inadvertently. And the point you're making is there's a prudential question in here relates to cost benefit kind of thing, where it has to be made by everybody that goes to war. Is it worth fighting this war considering the loss of life? And if it's a just war, then the loss of life that you know is going to take place, even in many cases innocent life, is better than not fighting at all, because the evil that would result would be greater.
Exactly right. And so I asked a follow-up question to her. And again, I was not trying to be rude. I was using the Columbo tactic exactly. And what I said to her was this. I said, if I understand you correctly, you are willing to overlook Obama's pledge to uphold an absolute evil because he might help us avoid a contingent one. And I don't think the question really resonated with her at first, mm-hmm. until I pressed it further. And her only response was, well, I know that right now war is worse than abortion. So up comes another Columbo question. Mm-hmm. To be worse than abortion, wouldn't an unjust war have to kill more innocent people than abortion does each year?
Yeah, that's a simple math question
A simple math question. And she agreed at that point. She said, you're absolutely right. That's true. And then I said, well, even if we take your claim, which she had claimed earlier, that there were 1 million people killed in Iraq that were innocent, that shouldn't have been killed, civilians, I don't buy that number for a moment. We have good reason to dispute it. But I granted it for the sake of the discussion, and I said, let's assume it were 1 million. How many abortions happen a year? Well, she said, it's a lot. I said, well, it's 1.2 million on average every year. Mm-hmm. So even if you're right about 1 million unjustified killings in Iraq over the last 6 years, the evil of abortion is measurably worse. Mm-hmm. But you think pro-lifers should support a guy who's going to use the entire resources of the federal government to perpetrate an even greater injustice on the unborn.
Mm-hmm.
And her response, Greg, which I'm sure you've heard and our listeners have heard, her response was, well, he's not going to do that. He personally is concerned about the high number of abortions.
Now, this is one thing that really mystified me, Scott, and the election's over with, so, we have what we've got, and I couldn't believe that so many people who were Christians and who were pro-life by their own confession somehow thought that Barack Obama was going to be a sympathetic in some way to this issue because of certain things that he said about, I guess this is the standard political move now from the left, is to kind of wag their heads and say, oh, yes, abortion, a tragic affair. Ah, yes, this is a terrible thing. Oh, we've got to do something about that. Tisk, tisk, tisk.
Right.
And they think, well, that head wagging is persuasive to them that this person is going to actually make a difference. But in fact, his policies were quite the opposite.
Well, they seem to be taken up by the fact that he communicated that he cared, and that was enough.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't look at what his actual proposals were. For example, that he stated the first thing he'd do as president would be to sign into law the Freedom of Choice Act, that he had pledged to commit tax dollars to funding abortion overseas, mm-hmm. which he's done
already. It was like the third day?
Right there.
He signed it. He just he eliminated that past executive order from Bush that was a restriction of those funds, and now he struck his own executive order. So one of the first things he did is started spending more money on abortions overseas.
Immediately. And by the way, that's going to drive up abortion rates overseas.
Mm-hmm.
He has also said that he would sign an executive order reversing.
Wait, Scott, can I interrupt for just a minute? I don't want people to miss this. When you pay for abortions, more people get abortions. it's that simple.
Yeah.
And so whether that's on the federal level or international level, when people are willing to pay, then people get abortions. When they can't afford it and nobody pays for it, guess what? They don't get the abortion. So the more federal money that is available for abortion, domestic or international, means more dead babies, period. And we're paying for that.
And I would argue that argument that you just gave is borders on being self-evidently true, but we can actually back it up empirically, and I'll cite some numbers in a little bit. I don't want to get too bogged
Scott,
down.
You know, Scott, it doesn't take – it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
Why then give the money? The reason we're giving the money, whether internationally and I think eventually federal funds will be available for domestic abortions, the reason is because people – can't have some people can't get abortions without the money.
That's right.
And so we are going to they're not able to exercise their constitutional rights, so we have some obligation to help them exercise their rights, so we'll pay for those things that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I mean, there is no other reason to give the money than that it will increase the number of abortions. That's the whole point.
That's exactly right. And this dear nun, who I think she meant well, I don't question her motives. Her reply to all of this that we've just been discussing is, well, look, Obama, he's going to get at the root causes that cause women to abort in the first place. Mm-hmm. He'll actually do something about funding social programs that will help women avoid making abortion decisions in the first place. He'll make health care more affordable for poor people. This is going to reduce abortion. Mm-hmm. This is exactly the line of argument I got from Tony Jones when mm-hmm. I debated him on the issue mm-hmm. just prior to the election.
Yeah.
His argument was, look, evangelicals, if they're really pro-life, ought to be voting for this guy because he's, unlike Bush, is going to get at the root causes of abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Greg, this is philosophically and empirically flawed reasoning.
Yeah, it's upsetting. Tony Jones is one of the leaders of the emergent church movement. For those who haven't heard that name for a while, we've talked about him in the past, and you know, we've
right.
had some interaction with him at Stand to Reason, and it's just been very frustrating dealing with this kind of thinking. But it's what you get from the so-called Christian left.
Yeah, you do get that, and it's really sad. But let's assume for a moment, let's get at this philosophical issue. Assume that we are in the 19th century, as Frank Beckwith asks us to consider in a recent piece he put up on a blog. He said, assume we're in the 19th century, and you have two candidates. One says he's going to leave slavery legal. He's not going to do a thing to restrict the legal right to own slaves. But he's going to introduce some social programs that will make it more agreeable to people to consider other options.
Mm-hmm.
And the slavery rates, as a result, will drop some. And the other candidate says, no, as a matter of principle, each and every human being has intrinsic dignity that cannot be infringed upon. Therefore, we're going to use the rule of law to protect the natural rights, meaning the rights humans have by nature.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to protect the natural rights of all human beings and use our legal system to get in line with the natural order.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank asks a great question. Which candidate really is the one that cares about slavery? Is
mm-hmm.
it the one that gives lip service to social programs but leaves the practice of slavery
the institution
legal?
Intact, right?
That's right. Or is it the one who actually does something in law to recognize what is true by nature, mm-hmm. that all human beings have intrinsic dignity?
Absolutely. This is so obvious, it almost infuriates me when I think of somebody like Tony Jones offering this argument.
Yeah.
By the way, that it's also a kind of a false dichotomy, because there can be a both and.
Yes, there can.
Even if – presuming there is some legitimacy to the idea that there are social pressures that cause women to get abortions, to get pregnant and therefore need abortions, I'm just going to grant that for the moment, but I'm going to challenge it in a second. Even if that were the case, there is nothing keeping us from addressing that part of the spectrum without at the same time addressing the other half, you know,
mm-hmm.
stopping abortion. Here's how you stop abortion. You make it illegal, for goodness sake. That's
yeah.
how you stop it. And then the abortion will virtually dry up. Will there be a couple of illegal ones? Yeah, here and there, but not 1.2 million.
No.
Every single year. And that number has come down a little bit. We can talk about that. One other thought here. I'm going to have to go to break in a minute, and I'd
sure.
love to keep you on for a while, if that's okay with you,
yeah,
Scotty.
Yeah, that's fine, Greg.
Okay. Sometimes I read this. You know, you mentioned that, well, then Obama will get at the root of why women abort in the first place. Let's see if I can figure that one out. Women abort because they're pregnant, and they don't want to keep the child. Okay, why did they get pregnant? Because they had sex. What sociological issues are entering in here after all? I mean, I'm trying to figure this out. Is it because they're stupid? It's because they're poor. As far as I understand, Scott, lots of wealthy women get abortions too.
They do.
I don't. I've heard this before, and it doesn't make any sense to me. When we come back off to break, after break, maybe you can enlighten me as to what I'm missing here, you know, about these sociological elements that cause women to get abortion in the first place, and then because any legitimate moves in policy to address that issue are based on the idea that the issue is a legitimate issue to begin with. Talking with Scott Klusendorf, late of Stand to Reason, our erstwhile director of bioethics here for, how long were you with Scott? 6, 7, 8 years?
7 years, I believe. Yeah. I think it was almost 7 years, yeah, a little over 7 years to the day.
Well, we are
just
deep.
Right about there.
Yeah, we were so privileged to have you on board for that time and glad to release you then to your own enterprise, Life Training Institute. When we return with Scott, we will get some more information about LTI and how you might connect with what he's doing. Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason, more in just a moment.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians, and it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them, and I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, that's the show where you get your head cleared out. Actually, the place to get a well-furnished mind. There it is. With you every Sunday, 3 to 5 Los Angeles time. And talking with my dear friend Scott Klusendorf who is just a person who's mastered the pro-life arguments and has not just in terms of the information, but as tactically as well. In fact, he's the president now and founder president of Life Training Institute, centered out of Atlanta, Georgia. Scott, how can people find your website and learn more about LTI?
Well, they can go to prolifetraining.com. And in the next month or so, we're going to be doing a retooling of our website, which is going to make it a little easier to navigate. But prolifetraining.com, and there they can get some articles I've written, which are similar to the commentaries you've had on your website mm-hmm. for a long time now. There are some audio clips. There's video clips of abortion and still slides that can be used for presentations. There's also updates on my upcoming book, which I'm excited gets released in about 2.5 weeks here.
That's great, Scott. Wow. So congratulations.
That's called The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Mm-hmm. And there's a little surprise in there for you, Greg, but I'm going to make you wait until the book comes out, and I'm going to encourage you to actually, you're going to be surprised twice, and pleasantly so. But I'm going to make you wait.
All right.
To find out what that is.
All right, Scott. Thank you. We'll look forward to it. The Case for Life, is that the title?
That's
again?
Correct.
Crossway book. So coming out in a few weeks. Keep an eye out for that. And by the way, friends, I would encourage you to go to Scott's website, which once again was what, Scott?
ProLifeTraining.com, all one word.
ProLifeTraining.com. Can they sign up for your newsletter there?
They can, and when we do the retooling, it'll be even easier. There'll be big buttons on every page,
okay,
but
super.
There is a link on the menu bar for them to contact us, and they can leave us an address, and we'll do that. And mm-hmm. we do a quarterly mailer called the 5-Minute Pro-Lifer.
Yes, and I get that because I support your organization,
you
Scott, and I want to encourage people, even if you don't support it, right now, go ahead and get that because every quarter you're going to get a great characterization of a way of dealing with this that is appropriate for the time, the moment, what's going on there. And it's a way of getting continuing education here and keeping the fires burning on this particular issue. We are talking a few moments ago, the first segment here of our second hour, Scott, with you about this conversation you had with a nun in a Catholic high school who said she really was advocating at the time before the election, voting for Barack Obama because he was the true pro-life candidate. And, of
right.
course, this is what a lot of us have been hearing during that time by people who were really otherwise pro-life and on our side. And now they're, it seems to me, defecting to the other side because they're being bilked by the PR coming from that side. And many were, in fact, and I think there was a significant, massive number of Christians that defected thinking, otherwise pro-life, but thinking that Obama was the pro-life candidate.
Right.
One of the reasons she gave, though, is because he'll really deal with the issues underlying abortion, mm-hmm. the kind of social motivations for doing so. And Tony Jones, in your conversation with him in the past, in public conversations, made the same point. What the heck are they talking about?
Well, they seem to think a couple of things. Number one, government is going to be the savior that fixes these problems. But it's not going to fix abortion by passing laws protecting the unborn. It's going to fix it by getting at the motives and the causes that they believe drive people to have abortions in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an assumption here that I think is very demeaning to women. And you and I have talked about this in the past. And that is that if somehow women aren't given access to abortion, and if we don't get at the underlying causes that cause them to do this in the first place, they're not going to have any ability to morally reason through to a correct decision. Mm-hmm. That we somehow have to remove the moral reasoning aspect and just get at the socioeconomic reasons, and then they'll do the right thing, but they're incapable of doing the right thing unless we can supply the needs that they have.
So we can't, in a sense, persuade them to do what's right, even under difficult
That's
circumstance.
Right.
We have to dangle some kind of carrot in front of their nose, so then they kind of follow this self-interested motivation. It
right.
seems to me that if you're going to appeal to somebody's self-interest, it seems to me it's almost always in what they think is their immediate self-interest to simply pay the $600 and get the abortion. It's all over then, as far as they're concerned. Now, we know that isn't true, but this is what if we're just simply appealing to self-interest, it seems to me that works against us, not in favor of our view.
I believe you're right, Greg, because when we tell women that there's really not a moral component here to worry about, that we understand their needs and we understand that there are things driving them toward abortion. What we're basically saying to them, if that's our primary message, and that's what Tony Jones was mm-hmm. pointing at here, if that's our primary message, what we're saying to them essentially is, your child has a right to life if and only if we can meet all your needs.
Mm-hmm.
But that plays right in to an abortion choice culture
mm-hmm.
that says children don't have intrinsic dignity
right,
and
right.
don't have intrinsic rights. Now, I'm not making an argument here, and you're not either, where we're saying that crisis pregnancy centers shouldn't speak to the needs of the client in the immediate context of that woman.
Right, and you and I speak
right.
you know, many times a year at CPC is to raise
exactly.
money for those enterprises. So.
We're talking here, though, about a strategy that's being advocated that we get rid of law, we get rid of moral judgments, and instead we just address these underlying causes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's something else about what this nun said that troubled me, Greg, and I asked her about this. I said, wouldn't a law that permits the killing of unborn human beings be unjust, even if no one had an abortion?
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine a candidate who said that he was personally opposed to spousal abuse while he had a voting record that was 100% in favor of men having a right to beat their wives.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose he went further, Greg, and said that, look, the underlying cause of spousal abuse is psychological. So instead of making it illegal for men to beat their wives, he proposed that we provide federally funded counseling for men so that they wouldn't be driven to do this. I think the public would look at that and be appalled.
Mm-hmm.
They'd see right through this smoke screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, there's underlying causes to rape, murder, theft, and so on, but in no way does that mean it's misguided to pass laws banning these
things. Yes, it's so ethically shallow to argue in this fashion. Another thing that comes up in this discussion, Scott, is you know, abortion rates went up under Bush. They went down under Clinton. They went up under Bush. I heard another person put it this way. George Bush hasn't saved a single life, and his whole administration never saved any lives. So we might as well just, you know, vote. You know, the court hasn't changed. And this is another thing that makes me just furious when I hear this. And I'll give my own response to this. Courts change slowly, and you work to getting to the point where you can make a change, and we are right at the precipice of being able to make a change, and then people give up on the courts. Right when, you know, we have a period of time when a president can elect the kinds of the kinds of judges that could make a difference. But anyway, that's another issue. What about the abortion rates going down under Clinton and then up under Bush? And Bush didn't really – the Bush presidency, a pro-life presidency, didn't do anything to stop anything.
Well, first thing, it's true. Abortion rates went down under Clinton. From 1992 to 2000, the abortion rate nationally dropped. But here's the rub. Clinton had absolutely nothing
mm-hmm.
to do with that.
Right.
Here's why abortion rates went down. As you know, under Clinton, the majority of state houses shifted from Democrat control to Republican. And these Republican-controlled state houses passed effective abortion control legislation that, among other things, cut off tax funding for abortion in individual states. They also passed informed consent and parental consent and parental notification measures. These same state legislatures passed bans on partial birth abortion, and though these bans were later thrown out by the court and only recently upheld in the most recent Carhart decision by the Supreme
mm-hmm.
Court, nevertheless, these other abortion control measures, tax funding for abortion being cut off, parental consent being initiated, these measures drove down abortion rates.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael New, who is a fellow at the Heritage Foundation, has done extensive empirical surveys noting the effect of abortion control legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And, Greg, there's just no argument about it.
Mm-hmm.
These measures had an impact.
Yeah, and
so,
go ahead.
So, yes, the rates did go down under Clinton, but that's because that's when the most important bursts of pro-life legislation was enacted
mm-hmm.
into law,
yeah.
And it brought down the rates. Now, as far as Bush, the rates going up, that's simply a lie. It is a blatant lie, and it's been documented now that it's simply false to say that. The truth is the rates continue to decline. Don't take my word for it. You can go to the Guttmacher Institute, which is an abortion advocacy organization, and in their report in 2008 called Trends in Abortion in the United States, they flat out say that the rates continued to decline during the time of the Bush presidency. So it's simply untrue. It was somebody trying to catch news headlines, knowing they could get this out in the news, and of course the mass media isn't going to go and correct it. They'll just
mm-hmm.
let it stand.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can think of three different reasons why this kind of legislation over the last 15 years or something that legislation that had freedom to flower because of as you mentioned, the state legislature and in a sense a little bit more friendliness from the Supreme Court, at least on these issues, why they had an impact. One of them is because some of these laws required that women be told exactly what they were in for.
Yeah.
I mean, we want to have informed consent. Why would anybody be against that? Well, we understand why pro-choicers are, because that means fewer abortions. When women learn developmental factors about their baby, when they look at sonograms, when they all of these kinds of things, women are informed and educated, and they change their mind. That's one reason. There's the impact of just laws that restrict people's morality, in a certain sense, is instructed by the laws. And when the law says no, people start getting the idea, well, maybe there's something wrong with it. When the law says yes, then they think there must be nothing wrong with it, you know. So, but the biggest one, and you and I have both written on this and talked about it at the time, because you were working for us at the time, was the impact of the partial birth abortion debate. Mm-hmm. And I had dinner last week with Wendy Wright, who is the president of Concerned Women for America, and an old friend of mine from the Hope Chapel days, Scott. And she affirmed this same thing, that the partial birth abortion debate had a powerful impact on people's understanding of the morality of abortion. Tell us why you think that is.
I think there were a couple of reasons. Number one is that the public got a sense of what abortion is at a visual level. Mm-hmm. They saw it. Now, it wasn't necessarily that they saw videos of it, but even the line drawings, which graphically depicted the procedure, mm-hmm. Those were enough to send many people recoiling mm-hmm. from that procedure. And I think both of us have friends who have described themselves, at least till that point, as being modestly, quote, pro-choice, who, when this happened, they began to rethink what mm-hmm. they were all about. In fact, even feminist Naomi Wolf has pointed out that what the partial birth abortion debate did is it, first of all, exposed abortion choice groups for their fundamental dishonesty in describing what abortion was. And number two, it gave the public its first serious look at the procedure itself. Mm-hmm. And now the word choice had a label attached to it.
It had blood dripping from
it. It had blood dripping from it, yeah. And it was no longer this abstract word just floating out mm-hmm. there. It now had fingers and toes and blood
right.
dripping from it.
That's right.
And that is one of the main reasons why I know the Stand to Reason speakers do this, and why we do it at LTI. We show imagery depicting abortion. We do it graciously and carefully, but we show it because mm-hmm. the public's got to see what's going on to have their moral intuitions reawakened.
Yeah, and this is part of your legacy at Stand to Reason. I was actually averse, I think for the wrong reasons, to this procedure before you came on board, and it wasn't long before you persuaded me the importance here of restoring meaning to the word abortion by showing what abortion actually does. And, of course, this idea of using graphic images the proper way is central to the material that you and I developed together called Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, which material you promoted at the Focus on the Family event years ago, which was then recorded in your speech. And I think that thing has run four or five times on Focus on the Family during the month of January. Indeed, didn't you get another run on that just this last January?
Yeah, I had no idea they were going to do it. But then again, I didn't know they were going to do it the following year either.
Sure, yeah.
Until the last minute. And this year, I didn't know at all. Not that they needed to notify me. But I was honored that they took a segment of the speech and ran it again this year. In years past, they'd run the whole presentation over a two-day period.
Well, I'm not surprised, Scott, because I think it was something like one of the highest-selling CDs or presentations that they've ever done. And many times the big sellers from Focus broadcasts are ones that are kind of crowd-pleasers, you know, how to have a happy marriage or something like that, somebody funny and witty and compelling and with lots of content, and people call in for the CDs, you know. In this case, it was this dark, dreary, overwhelming issue of abortion, but you gave it such power and such cogency, and you spoke with such passion, clarity, conviction, and usefulness, I think, to the listeners that focus listeners themselves just wanted more of it, and I'm glad they keep playing that.
Well, if I remember right, I ran some drafts of that speech by you before I actually gave it, so let's give a little credit where it's due.
Okay. In any event, this point, though, about graphic images is
sure.
really central to part of what we do, and we see in the partial birth abortion debate, it was that visual element that seemed to be the most powerful thing that turns
yes.
people's minds. That's why we don't want to abandon that. I'm against a break here. We got one more segment. Can you stay with us to the end of the show? Good.
Sure
we'll
can.
Do that. And then I want to talk to you about what we're facing under an Obama presidency and strategically what you think we ought to be doing about people who are deeply committed in principle to the life, and not only in principle, in practical terms. In other words, we're willing to do something about this so-called conviction. To the life of the unborn and embryonic stem cell research and the other things that are facing us very, very shortly, FOCA, Freedom of Choice Act, and the consequences of that. Coming up more with Scott Klusendorf, the founder and president of Life Training Institute. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel, one of the good guys here, equipping you to think every Sunday, 3 to 5 Los Angeles time. Maybe a different time if you're listening live in other markets. We've got about 125 cities we're in right now. And so glad to be part of American Family Radio. And now going into, what, our second month or so. Glad to have you all on board. My guest right now, dear friend and valued co-worker, as a colleague, broadly, Christian apologist, defender of life, Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute. Incidentally, you can get his quarterly newsletter, which is, what did you call it again, Scott, the 5-minute?
We call it the five-minute pro-lifer because it's something you should be able to read in 5 minutes or maybe a minute or two more. But I don't generally want to write a 5,000-word essay, and they don't want to read one. So I figure if I can give them something front and back page, it's
right.
One sheet. Not that there's not a value in longer offerings, which we have posted those on
right.
our site, but as our introductory mailer to people, we try to keep it short and sweet so that they can pick it up and read it and grasp it immediately
right.
what it's about.
Yeah, and I'm chuckling good-naturedly because I have to write those 3,000 to 5,000 word pieces with some regularity, so I know that it can be a chore.
And I've noticed on your Facebook page how it is a chore and how the enforcer has to hound you for them. So
that's right.
I've decided not to go down that road.
What she does is she's got her own Facebook, and we got a lot of the same friends, and so then she announces something to them, and she says go to Greg's Facebook and beat him up on this one for a while. So anyway, prolifetraining.com, all one word, no spaces. Prolifetraining.com is the place to go to get Scott's material. So I encourage you, please go there. And as Scott said, you know, this is a beta version of his website. He's going to be working on that and addressing it up here in the next couple of months. But for certain, sign up for his quarterly newsletter. You'll want to get that, and it'll supplement the kinds of things you get from us at Stand to Reason. Tomorrow, Scott. Now I want to shift gears and talk about
sure.
a new administration, President Barack Obama, the most pro-life candidate, according
yeah.
to some very misinformed Christians. Tomorrow he's going to sign off on the embryonic stem cell research thing, but before I get to that, I was thinking during the break about the conversation you were having with emergent church leader Tony Jones on the abortion issue, and I'm not sure if you asked him this question in so many words, but what came to my mind is, Tony, is abortion wrong? Just tell me that. Is it wrong? And if so, why is it wrong? And you got to answer that question before you can have a properly informed policy on anything from a policy perspective in government. And what do you think he would say if you simply asked him, Tony, is abortion wrong? And if so, what makes it wrong?
Well, I think I actually didn't ask him. I just said in the course of the interview as it moved toward its conclusion, I said something to the effect, if I recall correctly, that really the fundamental problem here with Tony's position is he doesn't believe abortion is an absolute evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're getting this goofy nonsense that Obama is the better pro-life view and why we're getting all this moral
mm-hmm.
equivalency on all these other
mm-hmm.
issues that are contingently wrong but are not absolutely wrong the way that abortion
right.
is.
Right, and just so listeners are not really missing the force of my point here, there's something I've said for many years, and it's in our Making Abortion Unthinkable material, and I know, Scott, you've used this before, but it helps to focus it. And the issue is simply this. If abortion does not take the life of an innocent human being, then no justification for abortion is necessary. You don't need all these justifications and reasons, choice, privacy, and all that other nonsense. Just have the abortion. If it's not a human being, go ahead. But if it is a human being, then no justification for abortion is adequate because we do not kill innocent human beings for the reasons that people have abortions. And, Scott, I think that statement there just simply crystallizes the whole issue. And if people like Tony Jones can get this in their mind straight and answer that only one question, what is the unborn, it begins to, and I think properly inform, all kinds of other issues related to this, like embryonic stem cell research.
It clarifies everything. Because if abortion doesn't take the life of a human being, as you say, why even talk about being personally opposed to it?
Mm-hmm.
Be in favor of it. And I think that's where Tony ran aground in his presentation is
mm-hmm.
he doesn't really understand the nature of abortion, or he does, and he's trying to eclipse people
mm-hmm.
to the true nature of
right.
it.
And, you know, we make the parallels, I think, appropriately in a certain sense with slavery because the same kinds of things are at issue, but it's not a parallel in degree because slavery didn't result in the death of every slave immediately, where abortion does amount to lead to the death of every human being that is aborted.
That's correct.
So it's much more serious in a sense than slavery and I don't know. Anyway, that frustrates me. So tomorrow, the reason that I wanted to lead this final segment with that point is because it really helps us focus on this only one question, what is the unborn? And if the unborn from conception is an innocent human being, even though it's at different stages of development through the 9 months term, and then even after that, from infant to toddler to youngster to teenager to adult to old person, there's a full range of stages of development. Well, then that helps to crystallize our understanding of the moral propriety of embryonic stem cell research. And notice I am emphasizing those two first words, embryonic stem cells. Tell us how it does so.
Well, if the embryos in question are human beings, killing them to benefit another person is a grave moral wrong. Mm-hmm. But if they are not human beings, then who cares? Mm-hmm. If you're not taking the life of a defenseless human being, there's no reason to oppose using these embryos to treat disease in others. I like the example that Frank Beckwith uses. He says, look, if I've got a good eye and you've got a bad one, do you have the right to take my good eye mm-hmm. to make your bad eye feel better?
Yeah.
It's really that simple, mm-hmm. Greg. This is not rocket science. Mm-hmm. If the unborn are human, it's wrong to kill them to benefit other people. Mm-hmm. But that question of what is the unborn is the one that is so often overlooked. And you don't have to look any further than President Obama's rhetoric, what Ron Reagan told the Democratic National Convention back in 2004 when he said...
So painful.
I love what he said, and I'm going to paraphrase him here, but he basically said, look, this research benefits human beings. But he never answered the question whether it benefited the embryos that were being discussed as research fodder.
Embryonic human beings.
Yeah, he just pretended. He assumed they weren't human. Yeah. He dodged that question.
And if you're against it, you're against it. You can have your own convictions about it, but you don't force your leap of religious faith on other people. That's kind of the way he did it.
Yeah, and he would never make that claim if we were talking about killing toddlers for research. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He only makes that claim about embryos because he's assuming they're not human beings.
Right,
but
right.
That's the very issue under discussion.
So tomorrow we're going to get a signature from the president that's going to open the doors to massive federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. And ironically, bring me up to date here. I remember about 2 years ago I spoke on this, and there was about, I'd say, close to 200 modalities that were also medical modalities already in play that were a result of adult stem cell research, but there was zero, that's a big goose egg, zero modalities that were in play helping people as a result of embryonic stem cell research. Have those numbers improved at all?
Oh, not at all. In fact, just empirically speaking, the most exciting research right now involves IPS, which is induced pluripotent stem cells. Now, these pluripotent stem cells have been reprogrammed. They're ordinary skin cells that have been programmed or reprogrammed to function the way that embryonic ones would. Mm-hmm. And these IPS cells are literally the rage of the scientific community right now. They are showing much more promise than we thought, and they've certainly outpaced anything that has been hoped for embryonic cells. Mm. The big problem right now with embryonic cells is we don't know how to control them.
They're too potent.
They are too potent, and they are capable of tumor formation.
Right, right.
And when you can't control them, how do you justify injecting people with them?
Yeah.
So that's a big problem.
Well, explain this to me, Scott. Why are people like Barack Obama and others so hot on embryonic stem cell research when nothing has been produced by it, and adult stem cell research of various forms, like the one you just mentioned, are so are not encumbered by the moral concerns, the moral problems, yet they are so promising? Why do this?
I don't have certitude on this, but I think I can draw a fairly plausible inference, and here's what I think is going on. This is a worldview issue. It's not about science, because if it were strictly about science, we'd be running full steam ahead with IPS technology.
Mm-hmm.
We would be running full steam ahead with adult stem cell research, because those are the things showing the promise right now,
plus,
not the embryonic one.
Plus, you wouldn't need federal funds because the private sector would jump in there with all the cash.
Absolutely.
Because of the promise. You need private funds for the ESCR because there's not that much promise. That's why you need public funds, because the private sector won't take the risk.
That's right. And what we see here is, I think, Greg, a worldview struggle. This is a debate about how we define human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Is each and every human being, regardless of its size, level of development, environment, and location equally valuable? Or do only some humans have value and the rest can be set aside to be killed if it suits our needs? Mm-hmm. That's the real worldview debate going on. Mm-hmm. So I think this is primarily a debate about metaphysics, value and grounding of human life.
I think at the core you're right about this. I'm more jaundiced, though, with regards to Obama. I think that what he's doing is he's playing the population who is deeply convinced that ESCR is the way to go, and it's only the religious wackos that are trying to get in the way. And so he is just kind of he's living out his leftist leanings here by tossing this bone to them, and everybody's going to applaud him as the great, wonderful, as they've been doing for the last couple of years, the Messiah.
They will, Greg, but here's the key thing to remember. If the public becomes convinced that embryos have a right to life, what does that do to abortion?
Of course, that's right. It's all tied together. You're right about that, Scott. Very good observation. One last question. You got about 60 seconds or so, or maybe 2 minutes, okay? And that has to do with FOCA. And we haven't really touched about that Freedom of Choice Act. It's something that Obama pledged to sign as his first act of president. He hasn't got around to it yet, but it's front and center. Could you tell us what FOCA is going to do?
Freedom of Choice Act, Greg, would sweep away hundreds of abortion control laws that have been passed that have resulted in a reduction of the rates of abortion over the last 12 to 14 years. It would repeal, for example, Hyde Amendment provisions, which forbid federal tax dollars from being used for elective abortion procedures. It would federally guarantee a right to an abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy that would mirror the federal guidelines in Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton, which both at the federal court level, for all practical purposes, created a right to an abortion through all 9 months.
Yes,
The other thing it would do is it would abolish existing state and federal limits on abortion. So, for example, the recent bill that President Bush passed banning partial birth abortion, that would likely go. It would abolish parental consent laws. And here is the biggie. It would abolish conscience clause legislation for physicians. So now what we have is the administration, the federal government, trying to drive physicians out of business who refuse to be complicit in the evil of abortion. If you're a doctor and you refuse to either perform an abortion
or refer,
you're a goner. Mm-hmm. And I like what the Catholic Church is starting to do, and I hope they stiffen their spines more. They've said one of two things. We'll either just shut our hospitals or we'll outwardly defy it.
Yes,
And you have to. At this point, civil disobedience becomes a necessity. It's not an option. And in the pro-life cause right now, Greg, I don't mean to sound alarmist, but that's the issue we've got to be looking at.
The lines are being drawn very, very vividly. And people, I mean, when you think, this shows how radical the other side is, that you aren't even allowed to say no to doing abortions or referring to abortions for conscience reasons. By the way, if you refuse to do either of those things, it doesn't mean a woman can't have an abortion. Pick up a Yellow Pages, go to A and B and ORTION, and you got all kinds of provision there. This doesn't restrict anything if they choose not to give the abortion or refer, but this is how aggressive this whole thing has become, especially under this administration, is now you won't even be able to opt out for conscience reasons. And this is so draconian. And it is so dark, I think, for at least the next 4 years that I just wonder what the Christians who voted for this guy are really going to think when all of these things start happening.
Well, and I hope the Catholic bishops have the strength and fortitude to stand up and say, look, we'll shut down 13% of the U.S. health care. We'll unemploy 630,000 workers if we have to stick to our moral convictions. Mm-hmm. Mr. President, we will defy you. Mm-hmm. And I think, Greg, that is not being unloving. That is saying we must obey God rather than man, and it's coming to that.
And this, and just to our Catholic brothers and sisters and friends, boy, they got a lot more courage than many evangelicals have on this issue.
Certainly more than Tony Jones.
Yeah, that's for sure. The website is prolifetraining.com. Go there and sign up for Scott Klusendorf's quarterly newsletter. Do that minimally, and I encourage you to help him out financially. He's just an unbelievable force in the movement. Scott, it's a privilege to have you as a friend and as a colleague.
Greg, always good to be with you. Thank you.
All right. God's best to you. Once again, prolifetraining.com, and Well, that's it for today, friends. Listen, go to our SDR.org website. Your homework this week is Science Held Hostage. You'll see that right there on the homepage. Read that. Learn from it. And let's see. I guess that's it. I'll see you next time. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.